and then moved to Hong Kong to join GT Management. That was in 1974. I was asking Jake, who's known John for a long time, when did you first meet John? And Jake said, oh, well, that would have been before the peg. I've also established today that I briefly overlapped with John in Tehran, Iran in 1974. I was a preschool student, and John was there as an even younger man than he is, visiting the Shah's central bank, reviewing the balance sheet. And if you want, afterwards you can ask him how much the Shah's crown jewels were valued at on the balance sheet. John still retains many connections to Hong Kong. Many people in town remind him as the editor of the Asian Monetary Monitor and the father of the Hong Kong peg. He first proposed the currency board scheme, which is still in use today. He's a member of the Committee on Currency Board Operations at the EMA, and therefore is out almost on a quarterly basis, and also a member of the Shadow Monetary Policy Committee in England. The topic of his talk today is the HKMA's secret plan to scrap the peg while you are asleep tonight. Oh, sorry. That's why we have so many press here. In fact, that's not what John's going to talk about. That's what Joseph Yam's going to talk about when we get him here. We hope in the next month before he officially retires. But you're certainly free to ask John about Joseph's secret plan to scrap the peg while you're asleep tonight during the Q&A. John's going to talk to us about an even more sobering topic, perhaps, emerging from the canon, and I think we're going to hear that we emerge from the canon into a valley. John, thank you very much for coming to the FCC today.
Well, thank you, Tom. Hello, everybody. It's always a pleasure to be back here at the FCC. It was the first club I joined when I came to Hong Kong, and the redoubtable Ted Hughes was my sponsor. In those days, the FCC was still in Sutherland House with that magnificent view across or over the men's urinals. The other particular memory that I have of this location is some rather fraught conversations at the time of the currency crisis in 1983, when a number of friends of mine met here regularly, and I came in need of some reviving tonics from time to time. In any case, today's topic is Emerging from the Canyon, Asian Prospects, in 2009-2010. I want to start by saying that I believe that this recession that we're seeing in the developed countries, and which has spilled over to an extent into the Asian and other emerging economies, is rather different in character from the standard sort of recession that most has characterized economic downturns in the post-war period. Typical economic downturn was triggered initially by inflation, to which the response of the central bank was to raise interest rates. That curtailed credit growth, that slowed the economy, and eventually inflation would come down. And then the key thing was that when the central bank lowered interest rates in response to lower inflation, borrowing picked up again, and the world went back to normality. This time it's different because, as we've seen, despite the fact that interest rates have been lowered to virtually zero in the US, the UK, in the Eurozone, and elsewhere, borrowing has not picked up. People are not willing to borrow. So this is a kind of downturn which is being driven by the balance sheets of the private sector. Households and financial sector institutions built up so much debt during the credit boom, the credit bubble, that they now need to deleverage. And no matter how low interest rates are, they're just not willing to borrow. Imagine a householder who's got a house, let's say, worth $200,000. He or she has borrowed $220,000 because the banks were generous to 3-4 years ago. But now the value of the house is only $150,000. And of course, that individual may well have negative equity overall. So no matter how low interest rates get, that individual is not willing to borrow anymore. So the recovery process is going to be dependent on the repair of private sector balance sheets, not just on how much credit or liquidity the central banks and governments can provide. And that means that the recovery process is not going to be the standard sort of V-shaped recovery that we've got used to in so many recoveries in the post-war period. Now, by way of background, I want to give credit to a man who was admired in the first part of his career and then denigrated in the second part of his career. And that's Irving Fisher, my personal hero, who often visited Hong Kong, and I saw him many times on those occasions, and indeed he was very helpful at the time of the currency crisis, was Milton Friedman. And Milton Friedman said, or held the view, that Irving Fisher was the greatest American economist. Irving Fisher became notorious for saying, ahead of the stock market crash of 1929, stock prices have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. And he continued to maintain that the downturn, the crash which occurred, was only a temporary downturn and things would recover quickly. Well, he lost a huge amount of money, and the firm that he ran went bankrupt. So his views were ignored by the economics profession subsequently. The world turned to Keynes, and as a result, we have very large government interventions nowadays when we have these kind of economic downturns. But Fisher's analysis subsequent to that is very interesting. You see, he was so humiliated by what he'd said and by his predictions that he went back to his books, he went back to the numbers. In those days, of course, there were no computers, to try to figure out what was the difference between the 29 downturn and then the 31-33 Great Depression. What was the difference between that kind of very serious downturn and earlier, milder downturns? And his answer, based on the data, was that serious downturns or depressions are typically preceded by a prolonged buildup of debt. Well, isn't that exactly what we've had in the last few years? We've had exactly that. And I myself have looked at other episodes of serious downturns in the last 2 or 3 decades. I think the most interesting ones are what happened to the Nordic countries in the early 1990s, what happened in Japan after 1989-90, the Japanese asset bubble in the late 1980s, and thirdly, the Asian crisis of 1997-98. In all those cases, credit had built up massively before the downturn. In the Swedish case, debt on the books of the banks, bank lending, was 50% greater than deposits. In the Thai case, in the case of Thailand in 1997, bank lending was 60% greater than bank deposits ahead of the crash. In Japan, too, debt had built up hugely, not just in the banking system, but in the juice end, the specialist mortgage lenders. and other financial institutions as well. So the common thread of all these serious downturns is that the build-up of debt is the culprit, and the problem is that balance sheets in the private sector have to be repaired. Now, why does it take so long to repair balance sheets? Well, again, I've looked at this and thought about it, and I think there are only three ways in which a balance sheet can be repaired. And that's what you need to understand. The first way to repair a balance sheet is to raise capital. Well, that's fine if you're a bank or a company and your share price prospects are good, or if you can get capital from the government. But if you're a household, you can't raise capital. And the background to the current downturn is a huge build-up in household debt in the UK, the US, Spain, Ireland, Denmark, Australia, and one can go on, as well as the financial sector. So, number one, you can raise capital to repair the balance sheet. Number two, you can sell assets and use the proceeds to pay down debt. And that way, obviously, the debt is reduced and you're in a better position. But the problem with that is that nobody likes to sell assets into a falling market. And that's what we've had up until recently. Well, we still have it in the real estate market. We don't have it in the equity market perhaps now, but nevertheless, prices are a lot lower than they were. So there's procrastination, and people typically don't take that step until the bank knocks or the bank comes calling and says, pay up. And the third way, and the only other way to repair the balance sheet, is to earn your way out. For a consumer, that means spending less and saving more, and we're seeing that shift in behavior in the US, the UK, and other developed countries now. And for banks and financial institutions, it means borrowing at short term at very low rates and lending longer term than normal out along the yield curve, riding the yield curve and widening bank margins. So the emphasis that we see in the banking system in the developed countries at the moment is to expand margins but not balance sheets. On the contrary, most banks or many banks are still shrinking the balance sheets. Now, to go back to Fisher, his insight was that when you get this debt repayment phenomenon going on, it does something very critical. It causes the amount of credit to shrink, and that aggravates the downturn, converting a normal downturn into what he called debt deflation. It causes a shrinkage of credit, and that worsens the depression or worsens the downturn. Now, that's exactly what we've been seeing. In the last 6 to 9 months, bank lending in America is falling sharply. Bank lending in Britain has stalled completely. Bank lending in Europe has also stalled. So credit viewed not only from the point of view of the banks, but also the wider non-bank financial system has stalled. And the tug of war that we see going on is governments and central banks expanding their balance sheets, the central banks buying assets and lending a lot more, and the governments borrowing hugely to try to boost spending, while at the same time the private sector is doing the opposite. We've got the shrinkage of balance sheets and contraction of credit going on. And the question for the outlook is, which is going to dominate? Will it be the expansion by the public sector or the contraction of balance sheets and spending by the private sector? And I think that's also a key to getting asset allocation right in the investment world. If you know which is going to dominate, then you're going to have rather different portfolios. Well, let me get to talk about Asia, because that's really what I'm here to talk about. What I've said so far primarily applies to the developed world. Asia went into this crisis in much better shape in one respect. That is that balance sheets were not nearly so stretched, not so leveraged, and as a result, Asia hasn't had the credit stresses that we've seen in other parts of the world. Of course, there have been knock-on effects from the developed world, but the picture in Asia is qualitatively better in many respects. The problem for Asia was that Asia was acutely dependent on sales of durable goods, manufactured goods ranging from cars and machinery down through electronic goods and toys and things to luxury items, sales of these things to the West. And in a downturn, the first thing that most businesses and consumers cut is those discretionary durable goods items. And that's why Asian exports have been hit so badly. So the question is, to what extent can Asia recover while the West is going through this rather slow and painful transition, the balance sheet repair process that I talked about, and come out of, and until it comes out of it, which may be 2 or 3 years, you know, down the track, what's the prospect for Asian growth? Well, I think that the most helpful way to think about Asia in this respect is to think about it as having a kind of two-tier growth process. When the West is booming and Asian economies are exporting very successfully and their exports are growing strongly, then we can see maximum potential growth in the Asian region. And that's what generated growth of, for example, 13% in China in 2007, and rates of growth of in India of about 10%, rates of growth in the rest of non-Japan Asia of something of the order of 6, 7, or 8%. But when the West is in recession and when it's going to be growing really rather slowly, the best that we can hope for Asian growth is a rate of growth which is somewhat less than that. And that's why we're seeing at the moment rates of growth in China of 7 or 8%, something like 6 or 7% in India, and rates of growth of maybe 4 to 6% instead of 5 to 8% in the rest of non-Japan Asia. And I think that that's a pattern which is likely to persist over the next year or so until growth in the West picks up again. Now, that's a sort of slightly nuanced view of the decoupling issue. What I'm saying is that Asia can continue to grow at its sort of internally generated potential growth rate, but it can't enjoy that sort of premium or supplementary increase in growth that it would normally enjoy when exports are booming. To my knowledge, there's only one case in Asia of a country and economy successfully decoupling from the West. And that was the case of Japan at the time of the second oil crisis. In the first oil crisis, Japan had a very large boom and bust, just like other countries. That's the period 1973, 4, 5. But in the second oil crisis, which was 79, 80, 81, by then, Japan had a floating exchange rate, and it had a much better monetary policy, led by primarily by the head of research at the Bank of Japan at that time, Professor Yoshio Suzuki. And the improved monetary policy led to extraordinary stability in the economy, and the fluctuation in the exchange rate meant that Japan was basically able to ride through the second oil crisis without any significant impact either on the growth rate or on the domestic inflation rate. But that's not the situation that we have today. Today, Asia is much more dependent on the West in terms of exports, and very few countries in the region have floating exchange rates, which is the sort of cushion, the insulator between fluctuations in the developed economies and fluctuations in in the emerging Asian economies. If we look at China, for example, China is obviously controlling its exchange rate. And in order to do that, well, in order to generate the current revival and expansion, they've had a huge fiscal boost, and equally important, money and credit growth has exploded. We're seeing money and credit growth rates of close to 30%. In my view, while this is fine for the short run, it is highly questionable whether this will be consistent with economic stability and particularly in stable inflation in China over a two-year time horizon. We've seen in the past, notably in the late 80s and then again in the early 90s, how quickly inflation in China can rise given, you know, overheated credit conditions. And although China is getting a lot of credit at the moment, sorry, excuse the pun, a lot of praise for the word, for the boost that it's providing to its economy, I think that this is can only be expected to achieve limited gains in the context of a fixed exchange rate system. While the exchange rate is fixed, there's only so much you can kind of boost your economy out of line with other economies. So unless we see some winding back of the credit expansion in China over the next 6, 9, 12 months, then I think that there are significant risks to China for the medium-term future. I wanted to say one other thing about China, and that is concerning the prospects for the renminbi and the currency becoming an international reserve currency. As you know, Governor Zhou issued a paper earlier this year advocating greater use of the SDR as an international currency. And that got a lot of attention in the international press as well as among central banks. I think that proposal is interesting, but frankly, I don't think it's going to fly. Basically, I think it was a way of expressing concern about the US dollar, but not a way or not a practical proposal for a new international monetary system. The problem with it is that the SDR, first of all, is a synthetic currency. It's not the currency used by any particular country. So it's never going to be an intervention currency. And the key thing about an international reserve currency, quite apart from meeting the normal criteria that it has to be, you know, medium of exchange, a unit of account, and a means of payment, quite apart from those things, it has to be an intervention currency and a currency of a country that has a significant trade and has significant international financial transactions. If you look around the world today, there are very few alternatives to the US dollar. There are serious problems in holding significant quantities of euro-denominated instruments for foreign central banks. The largest issuer of debt in Europe is Italy. Can you imagine the Chinese central bank wanting to hold very large quantities of Italian government debt? What about the pound? Well, I think there are equal questions over the future of the pound as there have been over the dollar. And then again, there are questions about the yen. Obviously, the interest rate there is not particularly appealing. So for all those reasons, I think that while this is an interesting academic debate, I think that's where it's going to rest for the time being, even despite the fact that more SDRs are going to be issued. So I've been told that I need to wind this up. I'd be happy to take your questions. Thanks very much indeed. Thanks.
John, thank you very much for a very interesting talk. We do want to get right into questions because I'm sure there's going to be a lot. And I'm happy, actually, to let it run a little bit over, given that we don't get you here as often as we'd like. Let me just ask a very straightforward one, and then we'll get right into it. If we wanted to learn more about Mr. Fisher, what work would you recommend? Is there a particular book or paper he's most famous for?
If you Google Irving Fisher debt deflation, it will generate a reference to a paper he wrote for a magazine, a professional economics magazine called Econometrica, which is about a 30-page paper on debt deflation. What's very interesting is that he sets out in that paper, I think it's 9 different stages of debt deflation. And you can pretty much tick off all those stages against recent history.
Questions from the floor. Please do identify yourself, unless you've known John since before the peg. Francis?
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. I hadn't intended to ask this question, at least not in this way, until I heard what you just said. But if fixed exchange rates don't give you much of a cushion in terms of dealing with the economic crisis, A, where does that leave Hong Kong? My second question, also Hong Kong related, is what's happened in recent months has pointed out the importance of having sound financial regulatory systems in place. And I'm wondering what your view is of Hong Kong's regulatory systems, particularly in terms of what we've seen with the whole Lehman Brothers affair and the agreement yesterday that, to some people's eyes, looks like the banks buying themselves out of prosecution.
Well, on the fixed exchange rate, this is a kind of a standard, what should we say, conundrum, which is thrown at economists from time to time. I mentioned Milton Friedman, who was a great advocate of floating exchange rates, and yet he was a leading proponent and supporter of the fixed exchange rate for Hong Kong. The point is this: there is a crucial difference between a pegged exchange rate operated by a central bank and a currency union or currency board operated by a basically passive monetary authority, which is what we have in Hong Kong. Fixing the rate in a small open economy ties the economy permanently to the economy to which its currency is pegged, and that's what we do in Hong Kong. Essentially, that's meant for Hong Kong that we've been able to import the benefits and the sort of adverse effects of U.S. capital markets into Asia and act as a kind of window on U.S. capital markets and as an international financial center here in Asia. But it does mean that we cannot control the price level in Hong Kong. We go from a mild degree of inflation to occasional deflation, as we've just done here in Hong Kong. But that is a better solution for a small open economy than having a floating rate. As we saw in the period 1974 to 1983, floating rates for small open economies are very, very damaging, much more damaging, you know, than the fixed rate. So there's a difference between fixing for a small open economy and managing the exchange rate for a much larger economy. Let me just explain that with a couple more sentences. If you contrast us with what's happening in China, China has a massive current account surplus and at times a big capital surplus, which it has to deal with by extensive sterilization. That leads to all kinds of distortions in the economy. At the moment, something like, at the peak, it was about 25% of banks' assets in China are held with the central bank. That's the sum of the reserve requirements, which China increases to mop up the excess money that it's created from intervention in the foreign exchange market, plus the bonds that it's issued in order to, again, mop up additional surplus liquidity. So that leads to all kinds of distortions. It's, in my view, it's delaying the development of China's domestic financial markets. It's permitted excessive investment in export-related sectors and so on. So for all those reasons, this produces distortions in the Chinese economy by preventing the adjustment that should otherwise occur. But enough on that. On the second question of regulatory issues, I think Hong Kong faces the same regulatory questions that many other countries face in the wake of this crisis, and that is, what is the best structure to have? Here we've had the banks regulated from a safety and soundness point of view by the HKMA, and we've had the SFC essentially looking after consumer protection, and then, of course, we've got the insurance companies separately regulated. And we're having exactly the same debate in the UK, but from a different angle. There, all the regulation was done by the SFA, the Securities and Futures Authority, and that was all removed from the Bank of England, and that arguably led to the Bank of England being much less responsive to the financial crisis in the early stages than it might otherwise have been. To answer the specifics, it's clearly necessary to have both the safety and soundness and the consumer protection types of regulatory arrangements, and for both of those to be very thorough and competent. But there's also overlaps which need to be addressed. And it's that area that is problematic. In the UK, there are proposals to have a joint committee of the SFA and the Bank of England. In the US, it looks like the Fed is bidding for that overall supervisory authority. I'm not an expert on regulatory arrangements, but I think that Hong Kong has done extraordinarily well only to have that Lehman episode. I mean, that's really the sale of those structured securities was perhaps a chink in the armor, but we have not seen major banking problems like other countries.
Was there a hand to the right? And also, just to those in the press gallery, don't be shy. Just catch my eye if you want to ask a question too. Please.
Hi, John. I'm Bob Chen from Bloomberg News. Earlier this month, Joseph Yam made some comments. He said that the Hong Kong dollar could one day become like the pataca in Macau, where he forecasted that maybe the Chinese yuan could become the daily currency of choice. And he also said that he could see stocks in Hong Kong being traded in both yuan and Hong Kong dollar denominations. Can you please share your thoughts on that? And my second question is, do you think that $2 trillion of reserves make yuan appreciation inevitable? What's your outlook for that currency?
Well, let me give you a sort of longer-term perspective on the Hong Kong dollar. Before the Hong Kong dollar, Hong Kong had silver. Hong Kong was on the silver standard, and there weren't any Hong Kong dollars. And gradually, once the Hong Kong dollar had been defined, it was a silver dollar, notes were issued by the banks under charter, and gradually a deposit base and lending base built up at the banks based on that currency. So from a zero start, gradually the Hong Kong dollar system built up, and it's quite conceivable, that it would gradually wither away again at some point, provided there was an alternative. In the old days, it was silver. In the future, it may become the renminbi, but that in turn depends on how quickly China moves to full and permanent convertibility. And I don't know how long that will take. I don't think it's going to happen quickly, because, if you have to remember that Britain only abolished exchange controls in 1979, and Japan only abolished exchange controls in the early 1980s, and those haven't really become international currencies in the way that the dollar is. So I can understand what Joseph is saying, but I don't think it's anything that we need to worry about imminently. I'm sorry, and the second part of your question was? Oh, for the yuan. Yes. Well, the $2 trillion in reserves, as I implied in my remarks, I think is a result of a build-up from which is associated with a lot of distortions. The basic situation is that China's productivity is growing much more rapidly than productivity in many other countries because it's catching up. People are moving from the farm to the factory, and that productivity growth justifies a higher real effective exchange rate. And the authorities probably haven't been moving the currency up fast enough to deal with that. They can continue to maintain the fixed rate, but it will have either very distorting effects or very inflationary effects, depending on what they do. But I won't go into the detail.
On the left, Susan? Susan Fenton from the anti-Bloomberg Reuters.
How do you explain this massive inflow of funds we've seen into Hong Kong in the past year?
I'm sorry, could you repeat?
I just want to talk about capital inflows into Hong Kong. We've seen massive fund inflows. What do you think is behind that? And are you worried about an asset price bubble here?
The question is, what do I think of the asset flows into Hong Kong, the massive asset flows into Hong Kong, and are we generating an asset bubble? Is that the question? Second? Yeah. Well, on the first, simply, demand is greater than supply. I mean, Hong Kong is open. We don't have any capital controls. And I think the world has accepted or broadly agrees with the kind of analysis that I've given you, namely that growth in Asia can continue irrespective of the downturn in the West. And investment flows tend to be attracted, you know, to where the growth prospects are best. So naturally, we're seeing a big inflow to Hong Kong, not only to take advantages here locally, but also, you know, the associated advantages of all the mainland Chinese listed stocks that are here also. I think that will generate, I mean, it is generating an increase in asset prices in the stock market, and we're seeing some revival in the property market. But I think that those will be limited by pricing factors. I mean, when prices get too far out of line, generally international investors are fairly cautious. It's not to say we won't have a bubble at all, but in the context of the rest of the world being rather subdued, I find it, I think it's unlikely that we would have, you know, a really serious bubble, unless that is China continues on its current course and we get a general bubble in China, which would definitely be reflected here in Hong Kong.
I never thought I'd see a Jake Vanderkamp doesn't have a question. He's been intellectually intimidated. Has there been there's another question right here, right?
Martin Savai, I'm an associate member. You mentioned a danger being in inflation in China, but where is it going to come from? I mean, there are these export workers who are displaced. There doesn't seem to be any shortage of labor in China. The commodity prices, okay, they're going up a bit, but if you're right about the West's prolonged downturn, there doesn't seem a lot of pressure there. So is inflation in China such a real danger? And here are my apologies in the limit of my economics. Don't we actually need some sort of inflation somewhere? If economists are right that China's surplus is the mirror image of the US's deficit, then either the US has got to inflate its debts away, or there needs to be some sort of inflation in China causing a boom which will reduce their surplus in that way.
I tried to be careful to say that it's not this year's problem. I emphasized that if it was a conditional forecast, if China continues with the current rates of money and credit growth, then there is an inflationary danger. Now, inflation is a process. It starts obviously with money and credit. That stimulates economic activity. First hits asset prices, then economic activity, and later goods and service price inflation, the CPI. So we're probably, we could be 18 months to 2 years away from any significant rise in the inflation rate. We've only had this very aggressive stimulatory policy in place in China for about 6 months. So it's early days, but I'm saying if that is continued, that would pose an inflationary danger for China. Worldwide, do we need inflation? No, we don't want inflation. The problem with this is, it's kind of like the question to the Irishman, how do I get to Dublin? I wouldn't have started from here. We need finance or the balance. This is my basic view. We need the balance sheets of financial institutions as a whole, measured in aggregate, to grow at roughly the same rate that we want the nominal GDP to grow. Now, if you take the period 2004 to 2007, credit instruments in the US and the UK and elsewhere were growing at something like 20 to 25% per annum. Repos at times were growing at 30% per annum. Commercial paper was growing at 22% per annum. Investment bank balance sheets were growing at sometimes 40 and 50% per annum. Those numbers are not compatible with economic stability, and they led to an asset bubble and burst. We now need a period of consolidation while either the debts are paid down and balance sheets are repaired. I don't think that we're going to have an inflationary solution to that. The inflation solution means you accept the debt at the current level and you pump up the asset prices again. I don't think that's a good long-term solution, because that would generate inflation at a higher rate for a longer period. So I don't think we're going to go down that route. So this is an unfortunate sort of payback, if you like, from mistaken policies in the lead up to 2007, 2008, and we've just got to work through it. But hopefully, one of the reforms that we'll see in the aftermath of this is that mandates to central banks are revised in a way that takes into account asset growth, leverage, and so on in the financial system generally, and doesn't only focus on the CPI and ignore the kind of black box between monetary policy, monetary conditions, and consumer price inflation.
I think we have time for one last question. David O'Rear.
Hi. Thanks for your comments, John. It's always interesting to get your insights. I was going to try the question of have we learned our lesson, but I think we haven't got another 3 hours for that, that one. And then I was going to try the question of, well, if the way to get out of the balance sheet household, the private sector balance sheet problem is raise capital, sell assets, or earn, what about deflating your way out? And I think we just took a shot at that one. And so what it comes down to really is a combination of the two, which is, I'm going to phrase it as, are we going to declare it's all over and done with when we get back up to the levels of the bubbles of the past, or can we actually take a step down, pull back, take a look around and say, well, actually that was ridiculous, why don't we try things at a little slower pace and not drive ourselves based on outrageous quarterly reporting of inflated bids because we're trying to make our bonuses.
Let me try to make a distinction. When I said that there's only three ways to cure a balance sheet problem, I was really talking on a micro level. Those solutions apply to individuals, individual companies, individual banks, and so on. Inflation or deflation is not a micro problem. They are macro problems. That's a problem of the aggregate price level for the economy as a whole. And you don't well, if everybody, let's take the second solution, that is selling assets to pay down debt. If everybody sold assets to pay down debt, you wouldn't necessarily have a deflation. If the central bank was able to create sufficient credit and money in the system to prevent that, that's what QE is all about. It's basically preventing a kind of 1930s negative feedback loop from causing deflation and things getting worse and worse. So I'd like to distinguish between micro balance sheet solutions and what the central bank's task is, and that is to make enough purchasing power available through the credit system to maintain stability. And in my previous answer just now, what I tried to say was, and to use Keynes's terms, finance needs to keep in line with industry. And what we've seen in the West, in the developed countries in recent years, is finance getting way out of kilter, growing way out of scale with industry. And we can't really allow that sort of explosive growth to occur again without precipitating another asset bubble and burst. So the lesson that, to reiterate, the lesson that I would hope that central banks have learned from this is to try to ensure through interest rate policy, through macroprudential controls, through attention to leverage, etc., to ensure that we don't get that kind of huge balance sheet expansion in the financial sector, which inevitably produces asset prices that are too high and eventually precipitates an asset bubble bursting. So that would be my solution. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We have run over a bit, but not a single person has left the room. I think that's as good testament as any is what a very wide-ranging, articulate, and thoughtful presentation we've had today. So, John, thank you very much for coming to the FCC. As is our tradition here, we do have a small gift for you. The board has dug up your old membership card. So on your trips, we hope to see you at the bar more often. Thank you very much.